Welcome to the Start a Brewery podcast, where we discuss all things relating to startups, open and growing breweries, from concept to execution. We are pleased to partner with All About Beer to bring you this podcast. You're joining us today for episode 008, Building Your Business Plan, Ownership and Organizational Structure. I'm Laura Lodge, here with Candace Moon, and we're excited to welcome you to our ongoing podcast journey. As your hosts and founders of Start a Brewery, we both have extensive experience in our areas of specialty. Candace is the craft beer attorney, having worked with more than 500 brewery clients over time. And my background is a mix of distribution, event planning, and craft beer education. You can find more about us and our contributors, plus a whole bunch of info and resources at startabrewery.com. To begin, we appreciate today's podcast sponsor.
Craft beer knows firsthand that the best ingredient is love. Arrived Point of Sale combines industry expertise, essential taproom tools, and a whole lot of love to make running your brewery easier. Scale faster with Arrived's mobile all-in-one system that offers flight tools, digital card on file, and award-winning customer support. See profit building tools in action at arrived.com/startabrewery. That's ARRYVED.com/startabrewery. Finally, a lovable point of sale, Arrived.
Episode 008 continues our journey through the various critical decisions needed to create a compelling business plan. We come to today's episode on the heels of discussing mission statements and values in episode 005 and developing your brand in episode 006, with a rest stop in episode 007 to hear from Mark Youngquist, Mitch Steele, and Sam Calagione about the use and importance of business plans, values, and vision in their breweries today. Fundamentally, today's topic gets to the heart of who is creating this business plan with you and how decisions will be made once the doors are open. If you are the one with the original dream and there really haven't been any other dreamers on board with you to this point, do you try to find people to share this dream or go it alone? And what if you need to raise capital, but you really don't want to share the control and decision-making once you're open? How do you find investors and manage them? On the flip side, how can a board of directors assist you? Can they hamper your progress? What about an employee stock ownership program, also called an ESOP, to give everyone a share of the challenges and successes? Let's hear from our guests about their experience with all of these initial ownership approaches and the risks and reward of each, and then the trials and tribulations of running the business after it opens with these ownership and decision-making structures.
So today's guests are Mary Bretman with Beverage Business Builders. I always have to say that. I feel like it's a tongue twister. Mary holds an active CPA license in Minnesota and California and has 25 plus years of experience in the corporate world. In prior lives, she has been a state auditor, a sales controller, an international treasury professional, a business owner, and finally a craft brewing CFO for a fast-growing regional craft brewery. Mary's current mission is to teach the industry what she's learned and to help people get to the next level in their journey. And so in 2015, Beverage Business Builders was born. Mary calls Minnesota and now California home, but has clients all throughout the country. Welcome, Mary.
Hi, everybody.
Our next guest is Jeff Mendel, also known as Mendy, especially today because we have two Jeffs. Mendy is one of the original owners of Tabernash Brewing Company, which merged with Left Hand Brewing Company in 1998. Mendy has been on the board of directors for Left Hand since that time, in addition to being fully immersed in all things with the Brewers Association. He is currently on the events committee for the BA, was co-founder of the Colorado Brewers Guild, and has been the director for the Institute for Brewing Studies and director of the Microbrewers Conference and Trade Show, among other leadership roles in the industry. Welcome, Mendy.
Good afternoon.
And last but not least, we have Jeff O'Brien of the law firm Chestnut Cambrone, practicing in the area of business and real estate law. He represents several craft breweries and distilleries, helping them with financing issues, real estate matters, the launch of their businesses, intellectual property protection, operational issues, and all of their other legal needs. He is a frequent commentator on issues pertaining to liquor law. Jeff is licensed in the states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and South Dakota. And someone who I often personally call when I have questions or need help with anyone in those areas. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's jump in. I feel like we've got a lot to cover today. So, Mary, we'll start with you. As a CFO and from your experience, why is it so imperative that ownership be considered carefully and vetted thoroughly from the very beginning of a business's lifespan?
Business owners are much like a marriage. So you have a business marriage and you have a personal marriage. And I've seen it where business owners get along and I've seen it where business owners don't get along. You are going to spend more time with your business owner spouse than you are with your personal owner spouse. So you have to have the same visions. You have to have the same idea of where you want to go and what you want to do. There's always been this question of, do you have several owners or you just have one or two owners? And in my experience, it's been easier to manage if there's just two or three people making a decision versus 20. So think about that. Usually when people are starting a brewery, it's the romance phase. So you can do anything and you can make Excel do anything in terms of projections. It's really important to get your feet on the ground as quick as possible. And so therefore it's important to make sure that the money is flowing exactly the way the Excel worksheet says it's going to flow. So it's important to make sure that you understand where your money is and you understand how to track it. Some of my best startups are ones that may have a working accounting system before they open the door. Because before you open the door, you have a ton of time to do anything. As soon as you open the door, there's a whole bunch other drags on your time. And it could be 6 to 8 months before you even look at accounting again. So my strongest recommendation to anybody looking to start a business is make sure you have a working chart of accounts and you know how to do the basics in QuickBooks Online or QuickBooks Desktop before you open the doors.
Gotcha. Jeff, how would you advise structuring ownership or organizational structure if your other owners or investors are active versus silent and or not involved at all? Is there a different strategy for when you've got everyone's very involved versus separately?
Absolutely. There's a lot of different things that play into that question. And it's one of the first questions that I ask when talking with a new client about, you know, what their legal needs are in terms of the entity is what is the plan, what is going to be the ownership structure, because of course, you know, you're going to have management issues. You know, if we're going to use, say, like a limited liability company, if we're going to have manager managed versus member managed, Minnesota is one of those oddballs that still has board managed for LLCs, but you can decide, is it going to be a small group of individuals that are making decisions on a day-to-day basis for the business? When I think the business, the entity, versus are you going to have more egalitarian and having majority rule and having everybody having a say? It factors into, you know, certain transactions and who needs to sign off on them in order to do it, all those kinds of things. And then also there are tax implications too. And Mary can probably speak to that too, but you know, whether you're using an LLC versus an S corporation, if you have everybody working in the business and it's going to be their full-time job, there may be a reason to elect to be taxed as an S corporation versus having some people who are, you know, involved in the business and then some of the silent partners. So, it does factor into all that. And the other question too is, even if some of these, you know, let's think about like investors, even though some of these partners might be silent, they might not be completely silent. They may want to have a say on big picture things like leasing property, selling the business, changing, you know, kind of the business model, borrowing money, those kinds of things. And so you might have in your operating agreement or a shareholder agreement certain things that require a supermajority approval or their consent if it's member managed for those big picture items. And that may be the only thing they care about, whether or not you brew a certain beer on a certain, you know, certain day, you know, or a certain week. They may not care about that, but what they care about is kind of the high level business decisions. And so we have to kind of write those into the organizational documents.
Yeah. I always tell people too, that just because you may not have given an investor any power in the operating agreement, it doesn't mean they might or they can't call you 10 times a day, tell you how to run the business anyway. So I always recommend vetting those people pretty thoroughly and make sure they're people you want to work with. Mendy?
I think it's very important to be able to distinguish between what are management decisions and what are board decisions. They're very, very different. Management decisions mainly focus on the operational, and board decisions mainly focus on big picture, future vision, strategy, important financing issues, such as renegotiating mortgages, things like that.
Agreed. Yeah, I actually recently, quite a bit recently, have also discovered that when people who are putting in a lot of money or, you know, want a lot of the power, you may or may not want them necessarily to be in like a named, titled position, because in the alcohol industry, if you're in one of those positions, you have to sign off on all the paperwork, and states want you fingerprinted and your personal financial information. And when you've got a bunch of owners who really don't want to do that, you're going to run into some problems. This has happened a lot for me recently. We've just been doing a lot of licensing in other states and trying to get people to provide personal financial information and get fingerprinted, and they really don't want to. So it's, that's been an interesting struggle.
I have something to add. There are two points. One is when you are looking to go into business with people, make sure they have the same value system. There may be some people saying 2% goes to charity. And if you have an owner that doesn't believe in 2% for charity, you guys are going to constantly be at loggerheads. Make sure you know what size you want to be. I've got some people say, let's stay small and beautiful. And I've got other people that say, make it big. So it's just a matter of making sure that everybody's on the same page. To follow up with Candace on the people may be biting off more than they can chew, it's been my experience that anybody who has 10% ownership of the company will have to put up a personal guarantee for a loan. And I have seen loans that have not gone through because the investors will not put their personal assets up to stake. So there's a whole lot. It's one thing to just throw $10,000 at it and just have fun with it, but it's another one to actually take a major percentage in a brewery, and that should really be thought through.
Agreed. So Mendy, as we learned in episode 002, you were part of a 4-person ownership team at Tabernash and now have had experience at Left Hand with both a board of directors and an ESOP program, Laura mentioned earlier, an employee stock ownership program. How have these different ownership and advisory structures worked in your opinion?
Well, repeating what I said in the previous episode, I feel from experience that 4 partners was too many. Again, it was great from a standpoint of division of labor, but it was challenging from a standpoint of decision-making, from being nimble, if you will. Another challenge was, you know, we may have had the same desires and visions for the business, but we had very different personal life situations. So we had one partner, well, 3 of the 4 partners were married. I was the only bachelor. One of them had 2 young children and a wife in graduate school. And, you know, we couldn't pay him enough to afford that, you know, to provide for his family. We had another one that was married and had 3 kids. And then another one married with no kids. And then me as a bachelor. And so we each had very different needs on the personal side of things. And that created challenges within the business. We all agreed that we should be compensated, but we couldn't compensate my 3 partners enough. And yet compensating all of us created a tremendous cash drag on the business. So that was one challenge. Another challenge, you know, the 4 of us each went out and got friends and family investors. So we each had groups of investors that we were bringing to the business. And that required us to create a board of directors. And that board, the purpose of that board is to represent the interests of the shareholders. It was the necessary thing to do, the right thing to do. The problem, I believe, was that we were young and we did not have much experience with governance, for one thing. We didn't have much experience with future vision. You have to be able to somehow think of what 20 or 30 years down the road might look like for your business. You have to be able to conjure potential exit scenarios. I believe that it's the founder's responsibility, if you bring investors into the business, to have some idea of how you're going to get achieve their exit. These are foundational supporters of the business. And so I believe they deserve that consideration. You know, after we merged with Left Hand, you know, when we were Tabernash Brewing Company, as I said, we had four partners. We each brought groups of investors. So we had 35 or so investors. And we had a 6-person board of directors. Left Hand, on the other hand, was a 2-person ownership team. And they only had 7 original investors. And so coming together with us really rocked their business world, because all of a sudden they needed to entertain a board of directors. And we had several different investor groups that needed to be represented. And it took some work, but we have managed very successfully this way now for 25 years. In 2015, we became an ESOP company. We felt that it would be a nice thing to offer our employees and maybe be a difference maker in attracting talent to provide them all with a piece of ownership. And we all, it's kind of an experiment. Will these people now act more like owners? Will they take a greater interest in the business and interest in how their jobs affect the business on a daily basis? Now the issue with the ESOP is it's a attached to key performance indicators. And so, you know, if we don't meet those, then there's not a contribution. And if you go a few years without being able to make a contribution, that feeling of ownership that you really want to cultivate begins to wane a little bit. There begins to be a little bit of, you know, what is this for? What is the value of this? Because I haven't seen it grow. I haven't seen any contributions to it. So, you know, the challenge for the business is to hope that everybody who participated in the ESOP is imbued with this feeling of ownership, so, and they're all pulling to achieve these 4 key performance indicators that would then unlock a contribution to the ESOP. So we're really hoping for, through the ESOP, a greater sense of dedication and commitment to the business.
Laura?
When you do an ESOP program, is there a percentage of ownership that's dedicated to that, or is ESOP always 100%? How does that work?
So the way ours worked is the company bought stock back from investors to create the ESOP. And the initial ESOP tranche, if you will, was, I want to say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% of the business.
Say that again.
Yes, since 2.5%.
2.5%
ownership. And it has grown. We've had some years where we've been able to make contributions to it. And now the ownership percentage is up above 6%. Okay. And so, you know, their percentage will only grow if we can make contributions to the fund. And I have to tell you, you know, I think it's a good thing. I like being able to say that it's something that we're providing for our employees. But it's a complex beast. I've been working with it for 8 years, and I can tell you, I still don't fully understand. You know, it's important to have somebody. Fortunately, our CEO, Eric Wallace, has dug deep into it and has a pretty good understanding of it. But you need there are certain aspects of the ESOP program you need to be on top of. Administratively, you have obligations that you have to keep to.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add, because I will have some startups ask about this in the beginning, and I should point out that anything that's complex from a legal aspect, you can also assume that's expensive. So this is not something necessarily a startup from day one may have the funds to invest in. Just like trying to be green from day one is it's not cheap.
We were 23 years in before we, initiated our ESOP. So that's to your point, Candace.
Yeah, I always tell people it's a great goal, and just like being green, but like you got to pick and choose what you can do at day one.
Yeah.
Financially.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let's move on a little bit. Jeff, as counsel to potential and existing brewery owners, what is your advice to them about bringing in investors?
So I have kind of a two-part answer. There's the practical and then there's the legal. The practical we've kind of already touched on of you need to know who the people are that are going to be your partners, because whether it be your buddies or your founders versus people that are coming in and investing, everybody's a partner, right? So they may be a different classes, but you all are partners in that business. So you have to, like it was mentioned earlier, if you're going to give, if the mission is to give some percentage to charity, you have to have people that are investing that are on board with that, or some of those things. From the legal standpoint, you have to consider securities laws. Candace, you and I are probably both guilty of using fear as a marketing tool once in a while with prospective clients. But when it comes to securities law, you are playing with fire. I mean, there are civil, there are criminal, there are administrative penalties to doing it the wrong way. And so if you're one of the first things I ask to as well is, are you doing this yourself? Are you self-funded? Are you going to a bank, or are you going to get outside money? And as soon as we hear I'm going to get outside money, we shift the conversation to the securities law speech. And the general rule, I'll do it real quickly here. The general rule is you either are doing a registered offering, which is like an IPO, or you are finding an exemption to registration. And that's at federal, and sometimes it's at the state level. And what those exemptions mean is there's requirements, there's restrictions as to how many, who you can raise money from, how you can market your opportunity to investors. What you can do online versus not online. And there's a number of different exemptions, and there's safe harbors. You have to follow those in order to be compliant with that exemption. In some cases, particularly at the state level, I think California is one of them, where you have to file something within so many days of the first offer before to make it take advantage of that state exemption. Here in Minnesota, for our limited offering exemption, if you're going to solicit more than 10 non-accredited investors, which is people that are less than $1 million net worth, you have to file all your offering documents. You have to submit those to the securities division before you even start selling. So you have to be aware. You have to be aware of when you have to have a plan of what you're planning to do. And I always like the response, well, I'm not selling securities, I'm selling notes. Well, the definition of security is very broad. Basically, if it's not a loan or secured by some kind of a mortgage, it's probably a security. If you're taking an interest in the enterprise, rewards crowdfunding is different, like the Kickstarter, when you're getting like glassware, T-shirts, or stuff like that. But if you're doing a mass offering of some sort of stake in the enterprise, whether it be equity, whether it be notes, whether it be convertible notes, whether it be a safe, all those things are securities, and you have to comply with those laws. And I think. That's one of the thing, the number one thing that you have to think about when you're bringing in investors. You have to have a plan. You have to know where you're going with it. You have to know, what your pool is that you're going to, is it friends and family? Is it something, are you going to have to go wider than that? Because we need to know that as practitioners to figure out, okay, where are we going with securities law compliance? Otherwise, a lot of people can get in trouble.
Very true. We actually, I refer all securities and even complex corporate transactions out these days. So it's not really my wheelhouse. Mandy?
I think it's important that we point out that if you're on a board of directors, if you have a board of directors, these people have fiduciary responsibility. And maybe Candace and Jeff can explain a little bit what that means and why that's really important to recognize.
You want me to take a stab at Candace?
I was about to say, I'll let Jeff cover that one.
All right. Yeah. So I'll try to condense it down. You know, and it's a good point, Jeff. Yeah. Fiduciary obligations, you have a duty of care, duty of loyalty, not only to the business entity, but also to your partners as to the conduct of the business, right? So yeah, if you're doing things that you're not doing things that are compliant with applicable laws, that can raise fiduciary issues. If you're in the process of trying to solicit investors and you make, say, a misrepresentation, that can come back as a breach of a fiduciary duty, and it can subject you to some serious civil penalties for doing so. So yeah, it's you're in a special position for being just the, you know, an owner of a brewery and being on the board or being a manager, if it's a manager managed LLC, you have some level of a greater level of responsibility for actions of the business in those positions.
Yeah. I always tell people my biggest free legal advice on trying to find investors is do not go on social media and ask people if they want to invest in your brewery. I think that would be considered a public advertisement, and you've already broken the securities laws that you want to be able to use right there. So
yeah, there's one exemption you can do that, but there's a lot of work that has to be done before you can take it to that far.
I think I'm going to ask you to delve into that a little bit later in the podcast.
Sounds good.
We interrupt your regular programming with a word from craft beer's most trusted point of sale, Arrived. Arrived combines industry expertise and essential taproom tools to make brewery operations easier and profits bigger. In fact, Arrived customers who use QR code ordering see an increase in tab size by almost 37%. Learn how they do it at arrived.com/startabrewery. That's ARRIVED.com/startabrewery.
Mary, I'm going to switch back to you. In your experience, when owners are involved with or overseeing operations, what can happen if they're not on the same page about how the brewery runs?
You know, it's an interesting question. When you're thinking about startup breweries, normally there's probably two partners that are the heart and soul of the brewery. One of which usually does operations and makes beer, and the other one is accounting and does books. And I kind of, for the most part, the owners typically defer to each other, and they kind of know about what's going on, but they don't necessarily get into each other's wheelhouse. An exception to that can be family. One of the biggest conflicts I've seen is if parents get involved in the brewery and say the second generation is the brewer and the parents put their retirement into the brewery, then there's a whole lot of, I told you so, it must be this way, so on and so forth. In general, my almost 10 years experience, no, just don't do it. Don't do it. Keep the same generations, unless the same generations together in ownership, unless you guys really, really know how to work together and you've worked through all your familial issues. I see a lot of stuff with parents and children that where the family dynamics comes into the brewery, and then you have issues. One suggestion I can make that to minimize these differences is that you start up a formal financials process every quarter or every month, probably every quarter to start. So everybody knows how much you're making, what you're doing, and everybody's on the same page. And we tend to not want to look at the numbers, and we just kind of make dreams about what they are. It's better to keep people on the ground, rooted, and understanding how much money they're making.
Laura?
Mary, have you seen some success with ownership groups in terms of setting some parameters before the business opens about how you're going to run house charges, how you're going to run comps, you know, what kind of levels you're going to put on are we going to do all specialty ingredients, things like that, that might be an expenditure that maybe not everybody would be on the same page with?
I've never seen it to that detail. Every once in a while, I'll see a departure agreement, but most times you don't even see that. It's like a prenup for owners. That would probably cause the least amount of drama in regards to breaking up if you ever need to break up. No, it's not common to go down to that level. That I've never seen.
Gotcha. Have you seen those cause a lot of problems in terms of so-and-so doesn't know that so-and-so is doing all those things?
Only if it becomes where it starts to completely change the dynamic of the company. And usually these comps aren't that big of a deal. It's interesting, you know, when Craft Brewery was making all the money it ever wanted to make, you could do as many comps and as many beers as you want. And as it got harder and harder, there's less and less is for free. So I think everything's kind of tightened up and it's changed the nature of the industry. And I've seen a lot of really good people leave the industry from before the pandemic and into the pandemic, because it's not necessarily the panacea that it was before the pandemic.
Mindy, did you want to add something?
Nope. Thank you, though.
Ooh, you threw me there.
You just had a knowing smile.
Deep fake. Deep fake.
What's that?
That was a deep fake.
Well, just for that, I'm going to turn to you. So have you seen a different attitude among owners when there's a board of directors involved in an advisory capacity?
Well, you know, I think there could certainly be adversarial moments in the owner CEO / board relationship. I think it's important to note that, you know, if you're a sole proprietor, you don't need a board. You don't have to have a board of directors. You can't create a board of advisors, right? And they have zero fiduciary responsibility. And that's a totally different environment. But I think if you put the right group together on management and board / ownership can work really well together. It's important that you staff the board with expertise that you may not have in the management office. And that's a real good way to create good working relationships between the board and the management ownership. It is for the board to be able to pick up slack on key skill sets such as financial planning. That's probably the biggest one in my book from the board perspective, how valuable finance experience can be. A lot of us people starting breweries, that's not our bailiwick. You know, we're more about making beer and selling beer. We're either brewers or, in my case, schmoozer and boozer. And neither of those functions have finance as a specialty. So it's really great to have financial expertise on the board that can really help create small but significant competitive advantages in the area of finance.
Mary, did you want to add something?
Yeah, typically I see board of directors come because somebody's looking for board of directors. So if you just have like two people that want to start a brewery, they're not going to know to have a board of directors. If they come out of the corporate world, they're going to be looking for a board of directors. So some of this is like business savvy. And if you're looking for those board of directors, I think you get a better product because you have more minds that can help you design and run the brewery. I think overall it's a good idea, but you have to almost be ready for it and want to do it. I've never seen it where board of directors are like forced on an owner. So I think it's either something you're looking for or something you don't want.
Gotcha.
Well, and I believe certain ownership structures require, right? If you have a certain number of investors, or if you're a certain type of corporation, S corp, LLC, I'm not sure specifically which, you're required to have a board, I believe.
Yes. I mean, I for sure in California, I assume that's a national thing. Jeff? O'Brien, yeah, did you want to?
Yeah, for corporations, I think, you know, nationwide, no matter what the state, I think there's probably a requirement of some minimum number of members of the board of directors. The LLC, not so much. It's usually seen manager managed or member managed. Doesn't mean you can't have it. Here in Minnesota, you know, I think we have a similar LLC act to you in California, Candace, the Revised Uniform Act, but they shoehorned in this unique board managed structure as a holdover from our previous LLC law. But most of the time, certainly for corporations, it's required.
Yeah, one thing I will mention, just for those of you listening, everyone on every director of a company, of a corporation, I guess technically, does have to report information to the Federal Alcohol Agency, TTB, and definitely in California, again, you'll be one of those people getting fingerprinted and providing all your personal financial information. Mary?
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say is that there's always a board of directors in the structure of the corporation, but do they actively meet? Do they actively advise? And that's what I'm talking about, an active board versus a board in the documents.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that was such a kind of a cool discussion. I kind of got lost in my questions. Let's see. Well, actually, let's stick with Mary. How can owners and investors be in sync with regard to projected growth and expansion over time?
One of the ways that I like to do it is to build some financial structure, making sure that you see that the financials are formally closed, that you see reports on a regular basis, and you meet and talk about it. That way, everybody sort of understands not only how much, quote unquote, money we're going to make or income statement discussion, or versus how much cash do we have and what can we do, a balance sheet conversation. So what I try to do is bring everybody together and start the baseline understanding of how they're doing, and then they know where they are. And then you start in the budget process every year saying, this is what we want to do. And then you track what you think you're going to do based what you're doing versus what you think you're going to do. So I think if you bring that together and you bring people together to talk about it, I find that works much better than just the magical thinking and not closing the books and only doing it and only sending your books to the tax person without actually looking at them.
Gotcha. Yeah, I actually, one of my, I basically tell my clients, again, I deal with a lot of small startups, that ideally your investors are not investing in you to make a profit. They're investing in you because they believe in your product. They believe in you as people. Obviously, they don't want to lose their money, but you got to have a special plan if your investors are expecting to make money, especially in the first few years.
In my 10 years of working in this industry, I've only seen one brewery pay dividends to its investors.
Wow. I mean, I'm not surprised. I just like to actually hear that like spoken, like is interesting.
Yep.
So,
and most of the balance sheets I see have close to a negative retained earnings. So you do it for the social aspect, not necessarily for the financial aspect of investing.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, Jeff, I'm going to pop back to you because I am very interested to hear your thoughts. I have some strong thoughts, but what are your thoughts about equity crowdsourcing? So for listener, if you can define that for people listening, and then your experience, thoughts, et cetera.
Sure. So equity crowdsourcing, equity crowdfunding refers to the, you know, mass marketing of an interest in the business, whether it be as, you know, direct equity or a note or, you know, a simple agreement for future equity is safe, done through particularly federal regulation CF. This was one about 11 years ago with the Jobs Act of 2012. There was that recognition that it was getting hard for small businesses to raise capital. So there was an attempt at the federal level to loosen restrictions that had been around for 80 years. And one, and the hard thing that particularly for a brewery prior to that act and prior to crowdfunding was that the available exemptions didn't allow any sort of advertising, like you alluded to earlier, Candace. You couldn't go on social media, you couldn't send emails out, you couldn't do, you know, have new, you know, stories in newspapers about it. It was very hard to raise money. And this, a brewery is in some ways is a type of business that you're not, a startup brewery is not going to necessarily attract the interest of venture capitalists and other professional investors. So it was extremely difficult in some ways, unless you had friends and family to tap to raise funds beyond, you know, bank loans and your own personal funds. So along comes equity crowdfunding, which took a few years, you know, after they, when it was signed into law in 2012, it took about 3 years, I believe, to actually get the SEC to release, you know, to actually publish a set of rules that everybody could live with. The first round was like 500 pages and the securities bar screamed bloody murder about it. And so you have states that also passed their own equity crowdfunding laws while they were waiting for the SEC. So I do a lot of this for a lot of different businesses. I've been doing it for a couple of years. And so I'll give you my opinion based on having done this for a couple of years now. It's not a panacea. It's not going to be the key for every brewery to get funded. It works for some types of businesses. It does work for breweries in part because I believe it works best for businesses that are public facing. If you're trying to reach, you know, we call them the non-accredited investors. An accredited investor, long story short, $1 million net worth, not including your primary residence, or you have $200,000 gross income as an individual or $300,000 as a couple. That's kind of, and there's other ways of meeting that definition. But in securities law, it's a heck of a lot easier to raise money through accredited investors than non-accredited, because the law deems them to be sophisticated enough. They probably have their lawyer, their financial advisor, their accountant involved with making investment decisions. And so they're deemed to be able to fend for themselves, legally speaking. What securities laws do, and a lot of it's consumer protection laws, focusing on protecting smaller investors, because remember, securities laws came about in wake of the Great Depression and the stock market crash of 1929. The idea behind them is to keep that from happening again and to keep, you know, keep smaller investors from losing everything. And so there's restrictions as to how much a non-accredited investor can invest into a regulation CF offering. You have to file a massive disclosure document with the SEC online. It's a public document before you can go out and raise funds. You have to, you know, work through an approved portal site in order to be able to do this. And there's compliance, there's reporting requirements ongoing. So it's not a perfect solution. There's never a perfect solution. I mean, the one perfect solution is have a lot of money to start your brewery. I mean, that's it. I mean, there is no easy way to raise money from other people. I think it's a tool out there. It's an arrow in the quiver, but it's not necessarily the be all end all. We'll see. No, you know, I'm working with some crowdfunding portals that are now also starting their own secondary trading system. So the idea being that you can, you know, being able to trade some of these equity interests on a secondary market out, you know, outside of the regular exchanges. Some people believe that that's the key to making crowdfunding work, is to be able to have this alternative exchange. But we'll see. But it's something to consider. It's actually, believe it or not, I think it's easier to use a crowdfunding offering for an already existing brewery that may be looking to maybe expand its tap room or, you know, purchase some additional equipment, not wanting to go out and borrow more money, because you have a customer base you can already tap. right? There's your non-accredited investors. There's your, you've got the patrons of the brewery, the people that like your beer. You can go to them with an offering. Maybe you want to retire some debt or something like that. You can use a crowdfunding offering to do something like that. It's still difficult, as a startup to come in and raise that money because you don't have that loyal fan base. Maybe if you were a home brewer and people like your, and you have a lot of friends and folks that might know of you, that you might that might do it too. But it's not the easiest thing to do. But again, it's one more thing out there that we didn't have a decade ago to try to raise money.
So one quick question that I have, because I haven't run into this yet, but I'm just waiting, is, so how do you report those investors to alcohol agencies? Like, assuming you get a, ridiculous number of investors, how do you track all those people and get their personal and financial information if you need it?
It depends upon the state. The TTB is obviously looking at, the principles. So they aren't as concerned at the federal level. Where it comes up more is at the state level, and it's more of the three tier question. If you have somebody that's, owns a bar or a wholesale license or has some other interest in another tier, and they're looking for that. Now, I can tell you what Minnesota has done is, If you're below a 5% interest, they aren't running background checks and they aren't doing all the vetting of those investors. And it's funny, I was kind of involved in inadvertently with them changing their policy on this. I have one of my breweries is formed as a cooperative, so that we have like 1,000 owners, and we were the second cooperative in brewing co-op in Minnesota to form. And so my client was getting some pushback. Our alcohol and gambling enforcement division initially was going to do background checks on everybody. And they called me in a panic saying, we're not going to get anybody to sign up if they're going to run background checks. This is going to take forever. So I called up another attorney friend in town who had done the first co-op. And I said, what did they do with you? And he said, well, they only did the board members and more than like 10% or something. So I call back our person and they said, we changed our policy. We realized that it was, we believe that it was incorrect and now we're doing it correctly. So, okay. So we're back to this again. Well, long story short, they find out that co-op number one now had like 2,000 members, and the alcohol and gambling enforcement officials calculated out how much time it was going to take to run background checks on 2,000 individuals when the renewal came up for this license, and said, we're reverting to our prior policy. So Minnesota's one, they do less than, if you have a less than 5% ownership stake, they aren't running background checks or doing anything like that. Occasionally, they'll snare the owner that has an interest in another tier. And so we're doing assignments of the interest to their spouse, because we haven't, we have the three tier issue, but they also have a policy that if the spouse is using independent funds, they can own an interest in a separate tier. So let's just say there's a lot of spouses in Minnesota that one has an interest in a bar and one has an interest in a brewery or a distillery. I'm like, that's okay. That's a nice loophole. So.
Gotcha. So I'm going to guess that, well, and so this might be what happens in California, that as the agencies start to see some of these come through, they may change some of their policies. That, like I said, that's what I was wondering. So good to know.
Yeah.
So I think we actually need to start wrapping up. I knew we had a lot to cover and a little bit of time. So I want to get everybody's best piece of advice you can offer a startup around this area of ownership, organizational structure, etc. So let's start with Mendy.
Well, I think first, limited number of active founders would be my first piece of advice. I think two is probably the ideal number of active founder owners. I like the idea of friends and family and outside I like the idea of a board of directors. I think it's a good support mechanism to have. Again, if you're going to have a board, you're going to have some of your board members are going to be investors who are representing other investors, but you want to make sure that you have a varied and very useful set of expertise on your board to fill in the gaps that the management team does not have.
Great. Thank you. Jeff O'Brien.
I would say, and this is selfish, I think making sure that you have a good team of advisors in these initial stages, not only tax advisor, not only an operations consultant, if you don't have somebody on the team, and of course the legal advisor. There are a lot of moving parts. There are a lot of ways to go sideways if it's done the wrong way. And as I always say to my clients, you know, you guys are doing this one time. We do this many times regularly. So you can benefit from our experience and watching clients that maybe do the right thing and some that do the wrong thing. And we can help guide you through that process to try to make you make the right decisions.
Great. I agree, obviously. And Mary.
Make sure that whoever you go into business with, you're on the same page, both in terms of values and in terms of what you want to get out of the brewery. You will spend more time and more energy with your business partners than you will with your personal partner. It is literally a marriage. And so make sure that you can go through the highest of highs and the lowest of lows with those people. And you both want and everybody wants the same thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Having seen quite a few business divorces, as I'm sure Jeff also probably has, and it's definitely not pretty. Aside from the expense and just the general difficulty, it's very emotionally difficult. So, yeah, the business prenup, that's a good thing to think about. Well, I want to thank you guys. I'm going to throw it back to Laura.
Yeah, thank you all. I think that, you know, I learn things from every single one of these podcasts, but I think this is one that I had the least amount of experience in, and I have about a billion questions for Jeff O'Brien about investors, but we'll get to all of them, I'm sure, since I get to hang out with you in Pittsburgh. So a big thank you to all of our listeners for joining us now and in the future for episode 008, Ownership and Organizational Structure of the Start a Brewery Podcast. We invite you to join us for our next episode, 009, continuing forward with building your business plan, this time delving into the questions around having a kitchen or not, and evaluating the prospect of creating a tap room, a brew pub, or a packaging brewery. This will be released within the very first minute of the day on Tuesday, April 25th. We now have a final wrap-up word from our sponsor.
Craft Beer knows firsthand that the best ingredient is love. Arrived Point of Sale combines industry expertise, essential taproom tools, and a whole lot of love to make running your brewery easier. Scale faster with Arrived's mobile all-in-one system that offers flight tools, digital card on file, and award-winning customer support. See profit building tools in action at arrive.com/startabrewery. That's ARRYVED.com/startabrewery. Finally, a lovable point of sale, Arrived.
While you're anticipating the release of our next episode, feel free to visit the Start a Brewery website at startabrewery.com, a free resource for those who are looking to open or grow their breweries. Please be sure to look through the task lists offered for each stage of the process, plan, act, open, and grow, at the educational resources and at the offerings from our savvy contributors in our growing library. You can also sign up for an occasional electronic update with new Start a Brewery contributors, content, events, and more great information on the contact page of the website. We also encourage you to explore the All About Beer website at allaboutbeer.com and perhaps pop in to enjoy one of their excellent podcasts as well. In the meantime, this has been Laura Lodge and Candace Moon, wishing you a terrific day and thanking you once again for joining us on our podcast journey to start a brewery.